Welcome to the IF Podcast. I'm Natalie Hopkinson, a fellow with the Interactivity Foundation. And joining me today for a discussion of learning styles in East Asia and the United States are Dr. Sue Goodney-Lee, a fellow of the Interactivity Foundation, and Tai-Yi Sun, a resident of the foundation and a PhD student in political science at Boston University. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you.
Both Tai-Yi and Sue recently returned from a tour of Southeast Asia, where they examined different learning styles and how they may be complemented by the Interactivity's approach to education. So this podcast will mostly be dedicated to their trip. They visited Tai-Yi's hometown of Hangzhou.
Yes.
But just to open it up a bit, in 2011, the hottest book of the year was by Amy Chua, Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother.
Frankly, there are many aspects of Western parenting that I know horrify Asian parents. You know, how much time Western parents let their kids waste, how quickly they let them grow up, what they are allowed to do, and also how poorly in some ways they prepare them for the future.
Did you ever come home from school with anything less than an A grade?
Oh yeah, it's happened.
What happened?
No, it wasn't pretty,
so
but it wasn't.
This book really touched a nerve in the general public, really inflamed a lot of insecurities all around the world, in particular because there was an excerpt from the book in the Wall Street Journal whose headline was "Why Chinese Mothers Are Superior."
I think that Western parents right now worry much more about their children's psyche and their self-esteem. You know, they always want to say, that's okay, don't worry about it. Whereas I do think that Chinese parents or immigrant parents, you know, they assume strength rather than fragility.
For traditional parents here in the U.S., you know, the idea of not giving your children any play dates or sleepovers, not being allowed to be in school plays, no television or video games, mandatory violin and piano lessons. It was pretty shocking to us, but Amy Chua's daughter was recently accepted into Harvard, which many people called a vindication of the superiority of her method.
First of all, I want to say that there is no gender-specific bias, so it's either Tiger Mom or Tiger Dad, which the Wall Street Journal made it sound like it's more feminine power. So in general, a parenting style rather than a gender-specific point here. And the second is there is a bias towards Asians thinking about that they are just good test takers, but it is actually that they're good at many other things as well. And part of it is due to the specific parenting style that we received.
So you're saying that there is a difference in parenting approaches there, and so there was some truth to what her approach was.
I actually think that Tiger Mom's story resonates with my own story very much. I play the violin. I started to play when I was 3 years old. So at that time, I wasn't able to walk probably or speak fluent Mandarin yet, but I was already picking up a little violin and started playing. And I've been playing the violin since then for 20-some years.
Tell me, what do you consider Chinese parenting?
Well, it's a bit of a stereotype, but they do encourage their children a lot, and they're quite focused on education more than the other areas. So education is foremost, whereas in most Western families, not that I want to be discriminatory, but it seems that, of course, they're still interested in their child's education, but not so strict about it.
Another point is that this type of parenting style does make the use of time very efficient. The downside is that we have either less freedom of our own time, or we have some controlled freedom. So as I recall, every individual is so disciplined that sometimes we don't even need babysitters when parents go out.
Back in your hometown and among your peers, how was the conversation around her book received?
When I was talking with my peers or my friends, my parents' friends, they're saying that there are certain things that are true in the book, but it was so generalized. So there are also many different parents that do not do it in this way. And you would find it in a lot of poor populations that they cannot afford the time to send their kids to music lessons. They do not have the adequate education themselves to teach their children or prepare them for future education. As you know, Amy Chua herself is an Ivy League professor. And so it's probably more typical in upper class elite population in Asian community rather than a general description of Asian population as a whole.
I lived in Korea back in the early 90s, and Korea at that time was starting to develop more of a middle, upper middle class. And, you know, those folks were applying the same kind of principle. And I mean, there were parents that would hire me to teach their child English. You know, their child was in elementary school. So, you know, we just, you know, colored and, you know, talked about words and letters. And, you know, I pretty much played with them. And folks would pay me, and this is in the early 90s, $30 to $100 an hour, sometimes more. And there was a certain status in, you know, driving your kid to achieve things that maybe, you know, you didn't have a chance to achieve or to go further than you went. And I think it's true here, too, that the parents that
absolutely
have more affluence are, you know, have their kids in 5 summer camps. And my kid's, you know, coming up on 3, and I've got him signed up for soccer camp and keyboard camp and, you know, and he's 3, right? Mm-hmm. You know,
in the 21st century, the best anti-poverty program around is a world-class education.
You know, it seems like there's an effort to sort of, at least in the culture that I know here in the States, there's an effort to try to find what your kid might be skilled and good at, and then, you know, really kind of amplify and push that. You know, in the Chinese and East Asian context, it seems like there's certain things that a cultured, well-educated kid is supposed to be able to do. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, one learns violin or piano, or, you know, you learn certain kinds of things more than necessarily just looking at what they might be good at.
So it's sort of a more standardized approach.
It seems like. Yeah. And Tai could talk more about that.
Yes, I totally agree. Because for a lot of children in East Asia, they are first exposed to a lot of different things. And sometimes they do not get the choice which one or which instrument, which subject that they want to learn. While there are more freedom in the States or Western countries that the children will be able to have a choice. And there are certain hierarchies even in the Chinese early education. For example, piano and violin are always better than playing a trumpet or viola or other instruments, which is almost absurd to many Westerners. But in China, it seems like there is a hierarchy. And sometimes some important things are missed out in these children's early education.
Tai, you were telling me that the school that you attended, which was kind of a special, unique school where students were immersed in English from a young age. And, you know, I met several of the students that are attending that high school now. And I mean, they're amazing. They're, you know, they some of them got waitlisted for Harvard or, you know, Wellesley or in there. They were really disappointed. This was the only school that, you know, they wanted to go to. And they're very, very driven. And you had said that there was some government plan, you know, in the works to change this school in some way to make it more comparable to other schools.
I attended Hangzhou Foreign Language School, which is the one of the top schools in the province. And before we enter the middle school, we had to take a provincial-wide exam in order to get selected. And there are only 80 out of about 30,000 students get selected. And so it's really competitive, but these students are privileged not having to take exams going into high school or even going into college, unlike many other students. However, there have been reforms from the top government and also challenging opinions from peer institutions saying that we have taken the best students and this way of selecting the best students from all the area and leaving them with not so good students is not the way to do. So since then, the selection process has changed to having a lottery. So elementary school students first have to be recommended by their school, and there is a quota for how many each institution can recommend. And from that pool, there is only a lottery. So it's by chance, not by how your performance is in the test.
Now, while you were there at Tai's school, you all facilitated a discussion of mm-hmm. IFS property report.
Yep.
So Sue, if you could just talk a little bit about what the report was about and what the setup was like and how it was received there.
Well, you know, it was a nice setup. It was this national park kind of sanctuary area where they had a nice room with a round table, big round table, and Lazy Susan. So there was food being served almost continuously. Food, as in many cultures, very important in a Chinese setting. And so we basically ran it, you know, an all day kind of thing. It was like from 8 till 4 talking about the various possibilities in this report. But of course, they got spun, you know, as any discussion of any of our reports tends to get spun by the cultural setting that you're in.
Absolutely.
You know, when I talked about regulation in New Orleans, it was very different than when I talked about regulation, you know, in D.C. So in this context, property, you know, is a very different sort of topic in a Chinese, you know, setting. And so some of the possibilities didn't really quite resonate in that setting, and others really, you know, engendered an animated discussion.
The possibility on intellectual property was mm-hmm. probably the best possibility that was discussed. And the students presented arguments from both sides. And because piracy is a huge industry in China, and so how people see intellectual property as a property was very interesting. And that debate was very different from how we discussed it in the States when I was facilitating the same report.
Yeah, it led to a whole interesting discussion about levels of development and, you know, whether in a Chinese setting there's almost some right or, you know, maybe privilege, you know, there's something by which, you know, wow, you know, we're trying to catch up with more developed nations. So, you know, if we reverse engineer something or something like this, you know, that there's a certain, why shouldn't we be able to do that? You know, are you trying to keep us from developing to the level you're developing? And so that was a whole interesting different dimension of the discussion. And then also the other possibility that had good traction was discussion of eminent domain. And in China, I mean, they can build huge projects very quickly. But one of the factors that allows for that is that they can come in and say, okay, we're building the train through here. You all are moving. And we got into some interesting discussion of, you know, is that okay? You know, for some people, the idea that it might not be okay just seemed completely foreign,
right?
You know, and of course, in an American context, the idea that the government's going to come and take your house and land is just, you know, an outrage. Mm-hmm. And if you're driven around the Beltway here in D.C., you have all these big curves going through the Bethesda mm-hmm. Chevy Chase area, mm-hmm. which were, you know, a result of the rich population there saying, well, you're not moving my house. So the whole highway curves around to accommodate these demands. So it was a very different context for us versus, you know, for their setting.
Mm-hmm. And then you also made a stop in Singapore as well, and you presented a paper there, Sue. Could you give us a little summary of what the paper was and how it was received in that context in Singapore?
There were a lot of folks there from around the Southeast Asian Pacific Rim there, including Australia, Indonesia, Singapore, you know, a lot of the region there. And the conference was specifically on looking at the topic of history as controversy, which there's a lot of controversial history in that region. And it resonated well with a lot of folks that were attending the conference. They thought, wow, you know, this IF approach to discussing topics that could be controversial in a way that raises various possibilities and sort of puts all the different possibilities on the table resonated really strongly. And people were like, oh, you know, I'd like to try that. But, you know, one of the big apprehensions is, okay, will this work in an Asian setting? Their model of learning is very different from a Western context. They don't naturally do a lot of discussion type of approach. So if we try to do this, will we really be able to engage the students in doing this? And on the way over to Singapore, I had stopped in Japan for a couple days and visited with a friend of mine from grad school and another person who had graduated from my program at Indiana University. And we, you know, talked about this approach in Japan since the earthquake and tsunami, but they're not sure how to do it. And my friend teaches at one of the large private universities in Tokyo. She has routinely 500 or 600 students in a class. So, you know, how do you engage that number of students? And even if you have a smaller class, like for some of their freshman seminars, which are capped at 23 students, mm-hmm. as instructors, they don't have the experience of facilitating versus, you know, presenting content, which is a very different way of teaching.
I totally agree. The if method can play a very important role in the education in Asia. Just to tie it together, both the story of Tiger Mother and the Singapore History Teaching Conference, I think we have now realized that in East Asia tradition, there is this authority, whether it's parents over the kid or the teacher over the students. There is only one version of the narrative, and it's encouraged to do repeating, reciting, and memorizing of the knowledge, lacking imagination and interaction. And this is why the Interactivity Foundation, this method of interacting with each other, let everybody share what they think about the issue and provide different aspects of the same issue, will be very important and probably critical to the children's development, and might actually enrich the part that East Asia children are lacking in their education.
I think once you get to a post, or at least late industrial, post-industrial type of society and economy, I mean, even medicine, law, all these things, you know, are changing a lot. You're not just memorizing. I think we're still teaching it that way, but, you know, really memorizing a bunch of information doesn't make any sense anymore because, you know, it's like we're in Star Trek.
Right.
You know, we're walking around with these little handheld devices that can tell you any bit of information you could possibly want to know in an instant. So memorizing things is no longer particularly useful. But, you know, we've, since the No Child Left Behind, we've, you know, sort of like ran to this, oh, we've got to test more, and, you know, and now we're kind of, I think there's some stopping and reflecting on, well, wait a minute, does this really make sense? Mm-hmm. Or do we really need to figure out how to talk, how to think, you know, how to think critically, and, you know, how do you know which information is worthwhile and which information is, you know, totally off base, you know? And so this sort of process is a completely different way of learning than what we've been used to in terms of delivering content.
And I also found it very important and helpful for my own teaching, realized now, because this semester I'm teaching a course that's called the Pacific Challenge, and one third of the course is on East Asia and South Asia, political history and economic history. So I'm being very careful about balancing views of my Japanese students, my Korean students, Chinese students, and American students. And so I have to keep in mind, and probably I would recommend to other teachers, that there is not just one version of the story, not just the victor's history, but everybody's history. There needs to be an interaction between the students, between the people.
You actually came over as an undergraduate, or was it in high school that you came over, Tai, to the U.S. to study?
Well, I was probably one of the exceptions, as Sue mentioned, that my high school was very liberal and we were exposed to various ideas to begin with since we entered middle school. But that's not the case in majority of China and other areas in East Asia probably as well. So I think it can be very beneficial. And learning from that, I'm now, Sue and I and some other fellows in the foundation are trying to put together this Harvard summer camp to introduce IF to a wider base of Chinese students who plan to go back to China. And so this is a process of gaining trust between participants and probably building up networks and norms. And so there is this accumulation of social capital, and we're hoping that eventually it will nurture the civil society.
That sounds fantastic. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we'll definitely have to have you guys back on the podcast to talk about that and see how that program is evolving as well.
Yeah, we'd love to do that. That would be really interesting to do. And in fact, this week I'm at the U.S. Institute for Peace doing an identity in intergroup dialogue training, which I think will be, you know, helpful as well. To, you know, think about the issues, because a lot of the, you know, putting out comparative narratives, you know, comes down to issues of identity and is really the postmodern exercise that was started in, you know, the 60s and 70s and is now kind of coming to meet with the pace of the technology and the times and becoming much more mainstream, to where people are realizing that, you know, how we see things and the assumptions that we make and, you know, the experiences that we have are really at the core of defining some of the conflicts and issues that permeate this society. You know, when you look at something like the Trayvon Martin case, you know, the reaction by some folks, you know, usually white folks, younger white folks that just haven't had a lot of experience with, you know, cross-cultural interaction or, you know, and they feel like, why is the president talking about this? And, you know, then you talk to some other folks, you know, especially, you know, Black men, Black folks more generally, Latino folks, people that have more experiences with interactions with authorities and police in particular that are, you know, different than the experiences that many white folks have. You know, it's a completely different dialogue. Mm-hmm. And it comes from a place of differing identity. But, you know, people don't realize that, you know, you think, oh, my experiences are just like everybody else's.
Right.
But they're not, you know, and it's those kinds of issues at those kinds of levels that, you know, we really need to talk about in, you know, this country and in a lot of other countries, but it's hard to get to that level. And I think that ability to put other narratives on the table and really examine, you know, where we're coming from, not to have a debate, but to think about the underlying assumptions, you know, is imperative.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I think that that's one area. We are a diverse country and always has been. So we have some experience in intercultural dialogue, for better or worse, particularly as we move into the global setting, they become more and more useful, mm-hmm. you know, and how mm-hmm. do we navigate the space that we're all sharing?
You know, and those will be the types of skills that really make the difference, you know, in success and, you know, being able to do useful work in the future. I don't need facts. I need to know how to talk to people.
Right. All right. This has been the IF Podcast, and I'm Natalie Hopkinson, a fellow with the Interactivity Foundation. And joining me today has been Sue Goodney Lee. Thank you so much for coming, Sue.
My pleasure. Very, very nice to be here.
And on the phone from Boston is Tai Yi Sun. Thanks for coming, Tai Yi.
Thank you.